date is Thursday, July 27th, 2017. The time is 2:02 p.m. This is a hearing of the District of Columbia Rental Housing Commission. The location is the hearing room in Suite 1140 North, 441 4th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. We're here pursuant to D.C. Law 6-10, the Rental Housing Act of 1985 as amended. I'm Chairman Peter Segedy-Mazak, and I'll serve today to chair this hearing. On my right is Commissioner Diana Harris-Epps, and on my left is Commissioner Michael Spencer. We have one argument today noticed for hearing at 2 p.m. regarding the housing accommodations located at 922 N Street Northwest, Unit Number 101. The tenant petition number is RHTP 30-724. The case is styled Ronald Harris, Tenant Appellant versus Tefri Zudu, Housing Provider Appellee. The commission notes that there are parties seated in front of it and would ask you to introduce yourselves, beginning with the tenant appellant.
Good morning, Commissioners. This is Daniel Harnell on behalf of Mr. Harris.
Thank you, sir.
Good afternoon, Commissioner. Aaron Sokolow on behalf of Tefri Zudu.
Thanks, Mr. Sokolow. I'd like to briefly explain our procedures. Our rules are similar to those of the D.C. Court of Appeals. Each party will have 20 minutes to present your case, beginning with the tenant appellant. The tenant appellant may reserve up to 5 minutes of your 20 minutes for rebuttal following the presentation of the housing provider appellee. The housing provider appellee must present all of your arguments within the 20-minute time frame and will have no rebuttal time. In its discretion, the commission will allow additional time in the event that our questions take up a substantial portion of your allotted time. Hearing is recorded on audio CD. We will issue our decision in writing and send it to the parties within 30 to 45 days. In this proceeding, we do not request nor will we accept any post-hearing or pre-hearing submissions from either party. Please turn off any cell phones or other electronic equipment. Now, I understand from the clerk of the court that there were very preliminary discussions with respect to some kind of settlement or some kind of resolution of this. Am I correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Is that correct?
We spoke briefly about potential discussions.
And I also understand that you would like to proceed with your arguments and
yes.
As if... Okay. We obviously encourage settlement if we can. But in light of the fact that you want to proceed with your arguments, if a decision is reached within the next week or before you ever get back to us, that'll be a final decision. So there will be no opportunity to settle. We are normally what I would do would be to adjourn this hearing until you've had time to talk to your clients and then get together for further settlement negotiations. But in light of the fact that you want to move forward with your arguments, we're going to hear the arguments, and we still encourage settlement negotiations. But if we were to issue a decision before we were to ever hear from you with respect to a settlement agreement, then we would issue our decision. That's what we can do for you today. If you, however, want to seek an adjournment of this hearing for a short period of time and then reconvene to allow you to try settlement, seek your client's instructions with respect to settlement and to carry on negotiations, we would certainly be willing to do that. But it's really your choice whether or not we proceed. And then if we do issue an opinion, that's going to be a final opinion. And before we hear from you or before any final agreement is presented to us, we don't want to get into a situation where there may be prolonged settlement discussions that prevent us from issuing a final decision if we reach that decision. And so the risk you take is that we reach a decision on this before you reach any settlement negotiations, any settlement agreement. But Those would be the ground rules as we move forward. Is that, are those clearly understood?
That is clearly understood. I do have one question, which is, if settlement negotiations are proceeding and it appears that the parties feel like they're being productive, which we don't feel terribly likely, but it may happen, would the commission entertain a request to delay issuing a decision if it was issued mutually by the parties?
I'm going to answer that based on my experience here. The only way I would conceive of that occurring would be if our settlement officer made a compelling case to the three of us that that settlement was the likelihood. And the settlement officer we have is a very good settlement officer, and she can probably tell us that if we were to get that notice from you that you are reaching some kind of decision. But again, were we to reach a decision or issue a decision within the next week, which is always a possibility, we're not going to hold back because we're under very, strict timelines here to get our decisions out. And those we've honored very closely. We obviously would encourage a settlement. So if our settlement officer tells us, look, these are progressing very well, and I believe that something can be done within a certain period of time, then we would certainly credit that. But absent any hearing from her on that, on the status of things, then, again, we would issue an opinion in this case.
Understood.
Okay. Thank you.
And you forego none of your, you're jeopardizing nothing that you would otherwise have. You can obviously appeal our decision, and, so you retain all your rights. It's just that settlement would be taken off the table if we don't get some kind of indication from our settlement officer that this is a strong likelihood, and that's given to us before we issue a final decision. Okay?
Thank you.
And thank you, by the way, both of you, very much for engaging in that. We've tried to encourage that. We may not have been very good at getting out the notice to parties that we encourage that, but we're going to do that a better job of that as we move forward. But I appreciate both of you, your sincerity and your commitment to that. That would, obviously, if we can avoid litigation, we always try to, as you would too. So we're not aware of any preliminary matters in this case except the ones I just mentioned. Would the tenant appellant like to reserve any time for rebuttal after the housing provider appellee?
Yes, I would like to reserve 5 minutes.
Okay, sir. Please begin then.
Thank you. May it please the commission. The standard of review here for commission hearings generally is arbitrary, capricious, abuse of discretion, or conclusions of law not infringing with the accordance of the act or in accordance with the provisions of the act. However, this case comes to the commission on an appeal of housing providers' motion to dismiss below. Under the rules of the Court of Appeals, as stated in many cases, including Clausen versus St. Louis Dispatch LLC, 906 A. 2nd 308, the review of a 12B6 motion is a de novo review. And the reason for this is that, as in this case, there was no hearings below. There were no credibility determinations that could have been made by the hearing officer. Any weighing of the evidence that the hearing officer engaged in would have by itself been an abuse of discretion. The hearing officer is not permitted to weigh evidence on a motion to dismiss. This is a case where the landlord filed a fraudulent claim of exemption to rent control. He owns more than four units, and he claimed in an exemption form that he did not. He then raised the rent by $1,200 a month on Mr. Harris, the tenant. The landlord's position in this case is that because of previous litigation, the commission is powerless to enforce the rent control regulations against the housing provider, and the commission should therefore affirm the dismissal of the tenant petition. We disagree. The commission is not bound to ratify the landlord's fraud, which is
make no mistake, what is being asked for here. A little bit of history, and then I'll get into my arguments. In 2014, the housing provider raised the rent in a letter from the landlord's attorney, which also included a copy of the claim of exemption from rent control based on the small landlord exemption. The exemption form claimed the landlord controlled fewer than four rental units in the city. Mr. Harris, the tenant, refused
Council,
to pay.
Council, can I want to interrupt?
Of course.
Prior to the notice that your client received in March of 2014 of the rent increase, had what was the when had the rent increase, when had the rent been increased prior to that?
My understanding is that the rent had not been increased prior to that. That is, the rent was $2,400 a month from the inception of the tenancy until that rent increase.
Thank you.
Mr. Harris refused to pay the rent increase, telling the landlord that the property did not meet standards of habitability, and that the rent increase was in retaliation for his complaints against housing conditions. The landlord then sued for eviction.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Was your client represented by counsel at the settlement negotiations?
Yes, he was. He was represented
Can
by...
Can I ask then why you discredit the whereas clause where there was clearly a reference to the exemption provision? I mean, are you claiming this is utter surprise?
A few things. First of all, the whereas clause is simply false. The tenant petition. So the whereas clause you're referring to is that the. My understanding is that the. Whereas the tenant objected to the rent increase, or said that the landlord was not entitled to the exemption. And it says that the tenant petition alleges that. The tenant petition does not allege that. So first I would discredit it by saying it's a whereas clause that's simply false.
If it were false, then what does that say about representation of your client at settlement?
Well, Your Honor, it was a different attorney, and I believe the attorney may have made a mistake by letting that in. I will say that in a hectic landlord-tenant settlement, the whereas clause is not typically where you spend your time focusing on it. It's also, I think, worthy to note that whereas clause is in itself, evidence of fraud on behalf of the landlord, of an intentional misrepresentation.
So when you look at your motion for reconsideration, or actually within the four corners of the petition that you filed before us, it's a little confusing. In some parts of the documents, it's represented that statement was a complete surprise, as the chairman kind of alludes to. But in other parts, more specifically, your initial notice of appeal, I read that to believe that actually there actually had been some discussion that led up to that, and that rather than it being a surprise that the clause was there, that it was actually purposely put there subsequent to discussions that had been had with your client with representation. Is that fair to say?
My understanding, and I want to first back up to say that, this is talking about negotiations during settlement agreements, so it's a little hairy just, to go in that direction. But my understanding is that during the negotiations, my client asked the landlord point blank, do you have more than four units? Mr. Zadow is named as the manager of some LLCs, and he claimed, no, I don't control any of those other properties, I'm just the manager. And that was the limit of the discussion that was had during the settlement negotiations.
So then when he then filed the next petition in September, is there a particular reason why he chose not to check box A, the issue of questioning the registration of the housing provider? Because in each of the tenant petitions that's filed, the actual box that would have actually allowed the issue to be addressed was never checked, which is the very first box. It's box A, which would be the flag to tell us and everyone else that one of the issues that we want to discuss is whether there's proper registration. But it appears that the only time the issue of proper registration really gets flushed out is in this argument about newly discovered evidence in response to the dismissal. And so there's a little bit of a question about this whole issue, the questioning of the registration. Why wasn't it brought up when there was the decision to file the second tenant petition in September based on the September alleged rental increase?
Your Honor, I apologize. I don't actually have the original petition in front of me, or rather the second petition in front of me. It fell off of my record, it appears. So my response to that is that the issue, you know, regardless if it was put in the original petition,
or the second,
certainly was not in the original petition, and was not intended to be in the original position. When the original petition was filed, my client had no reason to believe that the exemption was invalid. In the second petition, I believe that the box was checked that the rent was above the legal level. And it may have been simply an oversight. I don't have it in front of me.
Let me just follow up on what my colleague just said. On page 8 of your brief, you say at the last full paragraph, it says, there's no meaningful factual overlap between the claims in each petition. Put another way, the transaction or occurrence presented in 518 is Mr. Zudow's alleged retaliation and failure to abate an infestation. The transaction or occurrence in 724 was for fraudulent filing of a rent control exemption. And I am sorry, based on what my colleague just said in your response, I don't see that.
Well, Your Honor, if the...
Isn't the same locus of facts, quite frankly, a illegal rent increase? Isn't that the basis of this whole...
There is no piece of evidence, that is no fact, no piece of evidence that would go to prove the retaliation or the infestation that would also go to prove the fraudulent registration or the lack of entitlement to the rent increase. There is literally no factual overlap between the two. One goes to motivations of the landlord, and it goes to conditions inside the house. The other goes to property records.
Let me ask you about a case. Are you familiar with the case Shin v. Portals Confederation Corporation, 728 A. 2nd, 615, D.C. Court of Appeals, 1999? It says, we have specifically held that, okay, this is Shin contains that res judicata does not bar his claim because it is not based on the same cause of action as the landlord-tenant proceeding. This is fraudulent misrepresentation. We have specifically held that claims for fraudulent misrepresentation arise out of the same cause of action as an earlier proceeding based on the contract, i.e. lease. For example, in Lawfer v. Westminster Brokers, 532 A. 2nd, D.C., 1987, we held that a claim for fraud arose out of the same cause of action as an earlier breach of contract case in a foreign court. Because the issue of Westminster's alleged fraud was one which might have been litigated in the original action, the earlier judgment raises an absolute bar to Lawfer's counterclaim based on the same alleged fraud. In Comer v. Fisher, we held that a claim for fraud should have been raised as a compulsory counterclaim in an earlier breach of contract action because the claim attacked the same contract which was the subject matter of the original action. And I'm just wondering, based on precedent, not just cited by landlord, but which appears, at least in my research, to claim that fraudulent misrepresentation is really... would be in the nature of a claim under a contract of a lease, and in this case, you're raising it as an entirely separate claim, almost as distinct from the very action that you are claiming is the source of it. And I'm having trouble separating fraudulent misrepresentation as an entirely separate claim from the underlying claims under the lease in which a landlord in a rent-controlled unit has to fill out an exemption registration form as part of the entire process. So I'm having trouble trying to figure out where this is an independent claim that was not covered under res judicata or could have been brought under the initial claim. I'm just having trouble with that.
Certainly. I have two responses to that. The first, so it requires sort of stepping back a bit. Res judicata is an affirmative defense, and there's the three things that have to be shown is, one, that the original court had jurisdiction, second, that the claim the landlord wants to dispute was finally adjudicated in the original proceeding and is the same claim that was raised or might have been raised, and the third element is that no exceptions to res judicata apply. So the simplest answer to that goes to the third element, which is that the law is very clear. Pierce versus SEC is the case I cite in the brief and a number of other cases. And as the restatement states, a defendant cannot justly object to being sued on a part or phase of a claim that a plaintiff failed to include in earlier action because of the defendant's own fraud. So in this case, in the cases you're referring to, and I do actually now recall reading that case, this was a case for breach of contract where the facts of fraudulent misrepresentation were known at the time and definitely could have been brought at the same time. In the case at bar, the facts that shows the fraudulent misrepresentation were not known and could not have reasonably been found out at the time the original claim was brought. We weren't claiming, that. So because of that, the fraud exception to res judicata applies, and therefore there's no res judicata effect originally. The question the way that the court is attacking it here is from the second element, which is that the claim was finally adjudicated and was could have been raised in the earlier case. I think, and it is our position that the case law, one of the cases is Geico, Faulkner versus Geico, states that it has to show that there's a factual nucleus, and it gives a test for that. It says the court must consider whether the facts are related in space, time, origin, or motivation, whether they form a convenient trial unit, and whether their treatment as a unit conforms to the party's business expectations or business understanding or usage. Again, two arguments. The first argument is that res judicata doesn't apply because the fraud exception to res judicata applies. And I think that's the simplest, cleanest way to look at this case.
In order to get to the fraud exception, doesn't it beg the question really of a 60B in the original landlord-tenant? I mean, to be very candid with you, you're suggesting that the OAH conduct a fact hearing to crack open a settlement agreement from 2 years ago that the parties entered into across the street, which ultimately led to things. And even if they were to determine that there was something ill-advised about that, the issue is that that agreement still stands across the street, as opposed to doing what Judge Pearson suggested, which is file the 60B, make the representations that there's fraud, then try to do something with that, and then proceed forward.
There's a couple of problems with that. The first problem is that the court across the street, the landlord-tenant court, cannot adjudicate rent control questions. So a 60B over there is.
I think what my colleague is saying is that this isn't a rent control issue. This is a lease issue. This is a fraudulent. You're raising a contract claim, or excuse me, not a contract claim. You're raising a claim with respect to the fraudulent misrepresentation of the terms of an agreement, and that happens to be in related fundamentally to the lease, to the contract between the landlord and the tenant. And in this matter, the contract becomes the settlement agreement, and the settlement agreement's a contract. By the way, I think you have a misunderstanding of what a voluntary agreement is. A voluntary agreement, as you might know, is an entirely separate action under our regulations. It's 70% of the residents of a structure agree to be voluntarily bound by the terms of a rental agreement. You conflate voluntary agreement, that is small v, small a, with capital V, capital A, which then means that you do not need a rent administrator. You don't need the rent administrator's approval of a small v, small a agreement. In other words, what you're arguing is that the rent administrator didn't even approve the settlement agreement. Well, the rent administrator has no role in settlement agreements. The rent administrator has to approve capital V, capital A voluntary agreements. So this all goes to the conflation of, in my view, of a number of different concepts that make this considerably more confusing to me than it really has to be. No? Am I wrong on voluntary agreement?
Respectfully, I believe that there is a little inconsistency there, and that is that it's a fundamental principle of the rent control statute is that a landlord and a tenant cannot agree to pay more, to raise the rent above where the base rent is. If you allowed any small v, small a voluntary agreement to raise the rent above what the legally allowable rent is, that's a lease. That means that there's no such thing as rent control. So the voluntary agreement that has to be approved by 70% of the tenants in a single unit building, that would be a single tenant, still has to go through the rent administrator process to go above
the... I think, can I tell you something? I would be very careful where you're going now. I'd be very careful with your use of the term voluntary agreement and a 70% agreement. And by the way, this is really 100%, not 70%. I would be really, really careful where you're going with that right now. If you know this law very well, I'd say you would be probably well advised not to go much further than you are right now if you want us to go out on voluntary agreements as the basis of this claim. Because it has nothing to do with a voluntary agreement. If you had your statute, you can read voluntary agreements, and you can actually see what they mean. You don't have a one-unit voluntary agreement, one-tenant voluntary agreement. You don't.
Okay.
You have small v, small a, related to a contract. And you're telling us that how could it be voluntary, small v, if it was a fraudulent misrepresentation, because it can't be voluntary, because that means that it was that the voluntariness was subverted by a lie. That's what you mean. You don't mean capital V, capital A, necessity of a rent administrator approval, etc. That's really going into areas I would encourage you not to go right now.
Okay, I appreciate that. Then all I'll say is just that there would be a systemic, serious undercutting of the scheme of rent control if a voluntary agreement, small v, small a, were allowed between a landlord and a tenant to charge higher than the rate of the legally allowable rate of rent.
And this all goes to your claim, and I want, because we're going to have to move, and you'll still have your 5 minutes. The nature of your claim is that there were, that this housing provider had the opportunity to come clean and say, I own more than, you know, I don't qualify for this exemption. That had that occurred, which you then showed through all of these additional documents that you put on your motion to reconsider, that you viewed that as an entirely separate claim that really then was the source of an entirely separate cause of action called fraudulent misrepresentation, which subverted the entire process leading up to that, because your client was unable, was because of that fraudulent misrepresentation, entered an agreement, that is a settlement agreement, unwillingly, involuntarily, whatever, under false pretenses, and that the entire process from then was flawed because of that fundamental failure to disclose more than, to disclose that one is not exempt. Is that a fair way of putting it?
Your Honor, that's not how I conceptualized the case.
Okay.
Rather, I conceptualized the case as follows. The previous case in the landlord-tenant court adjudicated certain claims. It did not adjudicate the claim of the validity of the exemption form. It did not adjudicate the validity of the exemption form because the ability of my client to contest that in that earlier proceeding was undermined by fraud. But this claim here is not a claim for fraudulent misrepresentation. This is simply a claim that the rent was increased, that the rent was increased illegally, that the exemption form was invalid and fraudulent, and that the commission or the OAH should refund or order a refund of the rent that was charged in excess of the base rent. And that claim can go forward because the previous claim is not res judicata. The previous claim is not res judicata because one of the exceptions to res judicata is, and this is again very clearly stated in the case law, is that if a defendant's own fraud prevented the issue from being litigated directly. Okay. And that's what happened here.
I'm sorry.
No, please.
Just so I'm clear, you're saying that the housing provider's alleged fraud negatively impacted your client's ability to then proceed with a claim of improper registration. That's your argument.
That's exactly right.
He could Notwithstanding the fact that when he initially filed the petition, or actually in both the petitions, the only two tenant petitions we had, the first or the second, he never actually checked that box, which is a clear indication that he's questioning the validity of registration. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I again apologize if this fell off of my record, so I can't look at it right now. What I would like to make clear about that procedural issue is that the issue of fraudulent representation, of the previous registration being fraudulent, was clearly before the lower court. And to the extent, you know, had it, and it's, it appeared from the pleadings that, and from the order and motion for reconsideration, all that, that the judge was considering the registration, the validity of the registration to be a live issue, and, you know, rejected that based on the reasoning that she made. So I want to be clear that I do believe that was
Properly before.
And if not, we would have, you know, we had an opportunity to amend it.
So one last question. The second petition is based on this whole argument that there was a new illegal rent increase, the September 2014 rent increase. Can you in some way explain how that potentially is actually, I'm putting air quotes around the word new, when it appears that it actually sprung from the agreements that had been entered into with regard to payments of rent, not payments of rent. It wasn't new, it was a continuation of that.
Certainly.
The original complaint of the March of 2014.
Certainly. And I want to make clear as an initial matter that, you know, under the doctrine of res judicata and the exception thereto, the fraud exception, whether or not it was at issue in the first litigation doesn't matter because the ability of my client to pursue that claim was undercut by the intentional, and this wasn't just a failure to say it. The client, the landlord sent a letter to my client that said, we are exempt, here is our exemption, we are raising your rent, which is just a silent. As to whether or not the September increase is a separate action from the first one, if TP 53518, which if that indeed could have challenged the rent increase based on the fraudulent on the exemption, that rent increase was in March, and the rent increase we're challenging here was agreed to. And I'll put that in quotes because, again, in a settlement agreement in the landlord-tenant court in September. So it's not, you know, the landlord tried to raise the rent, failed, or didn't, because of the complaints about retaliation and infestation, the only matters that were eligible to be settled in the landlord-tenant court, and then instead raised the rent later. In September.
Thank you.
No questions.
Any more? Thank you, sir. And you'll get 5 minutes when the appellee has had opportunity to make argument. Please proceed, sir. Mr. Sokolow.
Thank you very much, Mr. Commissioner, Madam Commissioner, Mr. Commissioner. May it please the court. This is not a rent control case. The second tenant petition and this appeal that follows is nothing more than the tenant's attempt to undo the obligations under the August 21st, 2014 settlement agreement after attorney Ron Harris has already retained the benefit that he received from that settlement agreement. If you recall, this settlement agreement was negotiated within a period of 3 weeks that began on the day of trial on August 4th, 2014. And that trial was in landlord and tenant court based upon expiration of a notice to quit when the issue was whether Mr. Attorney Harris was entitled to use the property as his law firm address and was entitled to sublease to three people, all of which were in contravention of the lease. And the landlord gave forbearance on those issues and changed the nature in which Attorney Harris could use the property in exchange for a compromise on this rent issue and a resolution of this case and a resolution of all issues. The settlement agreement actually contains a full mutual release of all claims at paragraph 10. The settlement agreement also says that all sides concede that the rent increase was valid as of April 2014, although the landlord agreed to waive receipt of the funds until September of 2014. So Attorney Harris got the...
I want to ask you a question. If you were to go back to Superior Court and if they did file the 60B and open that back up, clear slate, what would then happen to the rent and all the agreements? How would that ultimately affect those negotiations?
I don't believe it could be done 3 years after a settlement agreement is filed. I mean, there's a one-year limitation on this. This tenant petition was filed more than 1 year after the settlement agreement was executed.
But you agreed that under 60B, there's that little exception very, very, at the very, very bottom. And fraud, based on the description, would definitely qualify. I mean, I'm completely aware of that 12 months. But you, as well as I know, that they can still crack things open if things are very egregious. And fraud might very well, if due diligence could be proven, allow that to be cracked open.
I mean, in theory, courts have broad discretion. If a Superior Court judge said, hey, 3 years later, we'll walk this back, then I'd say let's go to bench trial tomorrow because this was executed on the day of bench trial. So if there was no settlement agreement, then we should have been entitled to evict him 3 years ago on his lease violations upon expiration of a notice to quit. I'll also take this opportunity to talk about this word fraud because it's being thrown around very loosely in these proceedings because it's probably the only way opposing counsel could even take a good faith effort at saying, oh, we can crack this open all this time later. Fraud, you know, is a very serious allegation. It includes, you know, a mental intent to hide someone. And what's conspicuously absent from the argument is what my client did to fraudulently hide this. I mean, the parties had a disagreement as to whether my client was entitled to the exemption. This was discussed at settlement over a course of 3 weeks. These alleged documents were shown, and my client had an explanation that, look, he does manage properties for other people, but they shouldn't count against his rent control.
But just because of that, let me ask you this. Just because of that, wouldn't further proceedings to determine the nature of if there were fraud, wouldn't that at least clarify that, I mean, answer once and for all whether there, you know, outside of a number of different documents that may show your client to have more than a managing interest in a number of properties, wouldn't that at least clarify moving forward any contractual and other issues? I'm not necessarily saying rental housing under our jurisdiction, but wouldn't that be possibly a remedy in Superior Court, you know, further proceedings on an allegation of fraudulent misrepresentation on the contract itself, that is, on the settlement agreement?
Just not in this manner, Your Honor. Okay. If any litigant, 3 years later, after having received the benefit of a settlement agreement, could then just say, hey, but I'm not going to follow my part because it was fraud and now I'm entitled to an evidentiary hearing on that, then there would never be a settlement agreement. And that's explicitly what our Court of Appeals has said in favor of amicable resolution of civil claims, that the litigants are entitled to look to the plain language of the settlement agreement and enforce it like any other contract. This was not a fraudulent agreement. This was negotiated over the course of 3 weeks between two attorneys with the help of an attorney, mediator provided by multi-door resolution that was approved by the court. It's been relied upon by the Superior Court thereafter in another case that Attorney Ron Harris is appealing before the Court of Appeals, when Judge Campbell found that there was a willful breach of it when he rented out the garage to a pedicab company in contravention of the settlement agreement.
Are you referring to an order that would have been issued by Judge Campbell after, is that after the October 15 hearing? Would that have been an order issued by Judge Campbell?
There was an order
after the October 23rd, 15 hearing?
October 23rd, 20. You'll have to forgive me. I don't have my dates memorized.
Well,
there was a motion filed alleging a breach of the settlement agreement in the Superior Court. The motion was granted in part. The docket's a little unclear because initially a non-redeemable judgment of possession was granted.
I'm going to ask you, as an officer of the court, what exactly do you perceive the evidentiary value of a Xerox of something that you can print out as opposed to supporting your pleadings below with either copies of transcripts of previous hearings so the judicial officers can see and read and determine what the other judicial officers said, or actual copies of actual orders so the judicial officers in the next proceeding can understand what other judicial officers said? What evidentiary value do you believe that just printouts, scripts, little summaries by some court personnel recollecting at the end of the day what happened in the proceeding? What's the evidentiary value of that?
So, Your Honor, my recollection is that there wasn't a written order until well after this appeal was filed.
And so as an officer of the court, you're not able to then ask the judicial officer for an order, in asking them for to write the order in any way, make any efforts to do that. Rather, in lieu of that, or subsequently supplementing later proceedings with actual copy of the order.
I take responsibility for that from my perspective. Although the docket is, you know, far short of a written order from a judge or a transcript, it did summarize the conclusion of the court in an accurate manner. And I don't believe that opposing counsel disagrees with that summarization of those proceedings.
Right,
but point taken, Your Honor. Remember, all of the quote-unquote, and I'm using air quotes now, the newfound evidence upon which opposing counsel relies was in the recorder of deeds all along. So this notion that somehow my client took affirmative steps to prevent the discovery of that information, and that is the standard upon which our Court of Appeals stated in Drake v. McNair, This notion that my client took affirmative steps to prevent the discovery of things that all along are in the one place where in real estate transactions you put them so that everyone can be on actual and constructive notion, I just think that that's conspicuously absent from the petitioner's pleadings. There's not one, you know, the standard for proving fraud is higher than proving other claims. There's no allegation of what my client did or didn't do that somehow hid discovery of these smoking gun evidences. And again, they weren't hidden because we discussed them at mediation, as opposing counsel agreed with today, and as is made clear in the affidavit that was affixed to the pleadings, where Attorney Harris explicitly says, look, I knew about these because I asked the landlord about his ownership interest in other properties. So this was known before the settlement agreement was struck. That's why the preamble makes reference to that explicitly, and it's why the parties agreed to, you know, despite their disagreement as to the legal effect, it's why they agreed to resolve it.
Is Mr. Harris still a tenant of Mr. Zudu?
He doesn't live there, but yes, he's the legal tenant. He continues to collect money from three subtenants. My client hasn't seen a dime of rent in years because it's going into the court registry.
Would there be anything to prevent Mr. Harris from filing a petition now on improper registration, claiming, you know, the four-unit exemption does not apply here?
Yes, the preclusion on that is the fact that he's already challenged that and it's already been dismissed with prejudice.
As a separate claim, though, I'm not talking about his part. It was, as my colleague so well pointed out, it was never checked. The box was never checked. So you can't say to me that, oh, yes, that was already litigated. The box wasn't checked.
Well, I think that goes to the Shin v. Portals analysis, where it precludes not just any claim that's
actually... But that's a registration question. You see, the defense to registration is, look, I'm properly registered. Oh, no, you're not. What? You're not registered because you don't meet one of our exemption standards. What is it? Four-unit exemption. Totally separate, independent claim registration. Nothing to do with rent increases, just the fact that somebody did not tell the truth on a form that's filed with the rent administrator.
So my position is that because it's the same claim of exemption form that's been on file since before the settlement agreement, that by virtue of signing a settlement agreement that says I resolve all claims and I agree to dismiss my tenant petition with prejudice, the tenant is not precluded from raising a different challenge. And that's the whole theory, that you can't hold back on some of your claims and, oh, I'm resolving those nine, but I actually had a tenth all along and now I got you. You know, you've waived all of your claims, but I was secretly preserving some of mine, and now I'm free to litigate the ones that I preserved while you've already waived all of yours. And that's just not the way it works. If it was, I don't know how you'd ever settle a case.
Well, do you think that in order to bring forth, as the chairman had indicated, a separate claim on registration, you need to first beg the question as to, does it require an alleged illegal rent increase in order to bring that, or can you bring it in and of itself?
A standalone claim of improper registration.
Right, without a claim of...
I will defer to you. I have to concede. My understanding of that was that there was not a standalone claim of improper registration, that it was only raised as a defense to an improper rent increase. But
so what are your thoughts about the tenant's allegation that the September 2014, you know, enforcement of the $3,600 rent, whether that's an actual new rent or whether that's the same rent that was initiated by the March notice?
I mean, the settlement agreement is very explicit on that point. And at paragraph 7, it explicitly says, notwithstanding the valid increase as of March 2014, plaintiff is deeming defendant current as rent through August 14, waiving entitlement to all rent and late fees otherwise owed. In September, defendant shall pay the $3,600 per month in rent. So, I mean, it explicitly states it's not a new rent increase, that the rent was increased as of March. It's just that in consideration of the agreement, they're waiving enforcement of receipt of those funds. I mean, it's a legal fiction to say it's a second rent increase. The plain language, negotiated by two attorneys, with the other side being an attorney, makes clear that that's just talking about payment of the already raised and valid increase. Right.
Demanded earlier.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the result would be different if there weren't representation of the tenant? Because this law is remedial in its essence, in its core. And pro se clients coming up against a well-lawyered up landlord who may or may not be truthful on the registration forms. Do you think that the fact that there was representation here makes, during these discussions, makes for our purposes a difference, at least even on equitable grounds, were we to go to what counsel was suggesting? Look, this law was here to make sure that tenants do not, in rent-controlled units, do not receive rent increases that are fully consistent with all the requirements of the law. Do you think it would it have made it more difficult for you to argue what you're arguing? I'm just asking.
In this case, I do believe it is relevant, especially when part of their claim, as noted in the footnote of the petitioner's appellate brief, is that the whereas clause that explains that that there was an allegation of an improper exemption. I'm sorry. They are making the argument that they were surprised, that this was some sort of legal maneuver that was thrown in at the last minute, and they didn't read it or they didn't understand it, and therefore it shouldn't apply, plain language to the contrary. So the fact that this was negotiated over a three-week period with lawyers on both sides, with the party making the claim being a lawyer, with the assistance of an attorney who worked for the Mediation Division of Superior Court, yes, I believe that's a relevant factor.
One more question. What do you make of the judge's comment in her decision that, hey, I know this tenant. I know this guy, I've seen this at work before, you know. And with respect to Mr. Zudu, I wasn't sure if it was also with respect to Mr. Zudu, but referring to past encounters with one of the litigants. How is that supposed to influence anything, if I might ask?
I think it was in response to the petitioner's allegation that he didn't know what he was signing and that he should be entitled to undo the settlement agreement because he wasn't able to figure things out in advance.
But isn't that introducing evidence of prior something? I don't know if it's prior crimes, but some kind of prior reputation that comes in from really out of nowhere. I mean, it's just kind of, hey, I've seen this guy at work before, and he's maybe, you know, he may have said stuff in the past, and maybe, you know, he's not as innocent as we think he might be.
I would just note that the court does have discretion to take judicial notice of its own decisions, and the court below found it relevant in rebuttal of the tenant's arguments that he, you know, should be entitled to some exception to res judicata based upon newly discovered evidence. And I think that the court was saying it's just simply unbelievable that an attorney who's been through this before didn't know how to go on the recorder of deeds and do a Google search to find this, you know.
Can you take 2 minutes and just summarize? I think you've made very, you know, I think you've made your arguments. You've made them clearly. I just want, if you could just do summary, couple of minutes, give us major points you want to make.
All of the facts giving rise to this case occurred before April of 2014. The registration statement was filed before then. The rent increase was taken before then. After that, the tenant filed a tenant petition, and that was resolved, dismissed with prejudice. A settlement agreement that resolved all claims, a settlement agreement that made explicit reference to the allegation that the landlord was not entitled to the exemption that he had filed, which is disputed. Only after the landlord secured a victorious money judgment across the street does the tenant retain new counsel to file a second tenant petition to attack the exact same issue that was already resolved by settlement agreement, which is the validity of the March 1st settlement agreement. Opposing counsel referenced the case of Faulkner v. Geico, and that case explicitly says that for the purposes of res judicata, the scope of cause of action is determined by the factual nucleus rather than the theory on which plaintiff relies. Opposing counsel is making very good creative arguments as to why they should be entitled to assert, you know, this allegation on case one and preserve this allegation for case two, but it just doesn't work like that. Both cases explicitly are trying to attack the April 20, 2014 rent increase, and it's just not possible to do in that fashion. It's already been litigated. Again, this is not the forum, and there is no forum at this point, to try to undo a settlement agreement entered in a Superior Court case in 2014. It stands as a valid contract. There was no fraud in this case. There was a legal disagreement, and parties did what they should do in all civil controversies. They came to an amicable resolution that split the difference, and now that the tenant has retained the benefit of that agreement, he's simply legally precluded from trying to avoid the obligations of that contract.
Any questions?
No questions.
Ma'am?
I just wanted you to touch on where in this petition there's some indication with regard to the onus of attorney's fees and the problem with attorney's fees. I mean, it's like a...
The standard is less strict than the common law bad faith standard by statute as analyzed by our Court of Appeals. It's frivolous, baseless, and without foundation. I simply can't see how this case is not frivolous, baseless, or without foundation. When you dismiss a case with prejudice and you then refile it over a year later attacking the exact same issue, exact same transaction, the exact same facts and occurrences, in my opinion, that's clearly frivolous, baseless, and without foundation. And I would note that in this context, it comes at a tremendous cost to the landlord because everyone knows that there's going to be a Drayton stay entered in the landlord and tenant case. My client has to carry this property for years without seeing a dime of rent, and it's exacerbated when the tenant petitioner is literally collecting rent and profiting off of a property that he doesn't own for the duration of the litigation by collecting rent from subtenants, and the landlord doesn't get to see a penny of that. That is very serious leverage. And when a case is filed, after it's already been resolved, just to seek that, and in my opinion, it's retaliation for the fact that we saw it and obtained the money judgment across the street, that's the very type of case when attorney's fees are appropriate. And I believe that was an appropriate finding by the ALJ in this case.
Thank you.
Sir.
Thank you. We'll start where the last argument ended. The opposing counsel just a moment ago, about 5 minutes ago, said it's a good argument, a creative argument, but loses. That's not a frivolous argument. Our arguments here are in good faith and well-researched, and we can argue about the validity of them, and we believe that we're right, but it's certainly a good faith argument. Going forward from that,
Mr. Harris is not profiting off of this at all. Mr. Harris is paying the money that he's collecting from his subtenants into the registry every month. Mr. Harris has collected actually less from his subtenants than the increased level of rent every month, so he's actually losing money on this case. I just want to clear that up from an equitable standpoint. Mr. Harris is not claiming ignorance of the law. He's not claiming, oh, I didn't know about rent control. He knew it existed, and he knew that it had to be followed. But what he didn't have any reason to believe that Mr. Zadow hadn't made a fraudulent rent claim of rent exemption, and that the one that he filed with the D.C. government and sent to him was in fact a lie. As far as how the issue of recently discovered evidence and if it could have been discovered with due diligence, I myself did the research. I had to look through every LLC that Mr. Zadow was associated with by address or anything else. There's dozens of them. I then had to go through each filing in the deeds office for each of those properties to find something. And generally, you don't find anything. He may well own more than just the one building that I'm sure of, but unfortunately, in most cases, there's no indication in the deeds office of who owns an LLC, as opposed to simply manages it. I was able to discover who owned the LLC because Mr. Zadow signed the paper as a sole owner. It was a grant of a deed of trust, I think, on one of the properties as sole owner, and that was the only way I found it. It took weeks and weeks of hard research. So to imply that my client should have known that he can't rely on this form of exemption that was filed with the D.C. government, sworn under oath. He can't rely on that because he should have known that, well, people lie, so therefore you need to go to the ends of the earth, spend, you know, like a week of attorney time researching it, I think is an invalid argument. My client could not have discovered this with due diligence, and furthermore, the case law is very clear. Ignorance of a party does not avoid the bar of res judicata unless that ignorance was caused by misrepresentation or concealment of opposing party. There was a concealment here and a misrepresentation, a explicit misrepresentation that was given to my client. My client's not arguing that this shouldn't be happen because it isn't, or that he should be able to take a second.
Can I ask you a question? Did you argue these same points below?
Yes, Your Honor.
And exactly what you said, I mean, Pierce, et cetera, you argued, you made essentially the same arguments below, correct?
It's essentially the same arguments, Your Honor. It was, you know, we didn't cite as many cases below.
Can I ask why your notice of appeal contains like maybe three or four additional kinds of issues on appeal that may not have kind of appeared are you maintaining every one of your issues on appeal was really raised below at some point? Is that
Your Honor, when I filed that notice of appeal, which I don't have in front of me, so I can't speak to each thing on it, it was to preserve our rights.
I got you. That's fine. You don't have to say any more. That's all. That's fine.
Thank you. Finally, I want to say the victims here, you know, are not Mr. Harris predominantly. He has had to spend more money in rent, but the real victims are the subtenants, the three people who live in this building. He doesn't charge more than the rent that he pays. Actually, the previous case that was referenced in the brief was Mr. Harris's subtenants claimed that he was charging him $100 a month more than he was paying in rent, and he gave them the money back, and that was the resolution. The victims here are the three subtenants who are paying between them an additional $1,200 a month, and the. You know, there has to be a way to challenge this. It doesn't. It simply defies explanation to say for this body, which is to enforce the Rent Control Act according to its purposes as set up by the council, to say that you know, even though there is a clear-cut exception as read in res judicata in the case law for fraudulent concealment, that it's not going to apply, and therefore the tenants, because the tenants' representative, which was Mr. Harrison in the landlord tenant case before, because he was lied to and he believed those lies, that they should have to pay more and they can never be challenged, and that's in effect what's going on here. The ability of potentially going through a Rule 60, you know, I don't think it would work because I would get the same accusations of frivolous conduct and it being res judicata. And additionally, this body has the power, according to several cases, including Drayden, has the primary jurisdiction on this question. So I would ask the commission to please reverse the ruling of the lower court and at least allow for an evidentiary hearing into whether or not there was fraudulent concealment. Because at this point, we're just dealing with papers and pleadings. There's been no argument and no formal opportunity to present evidence.
Commissioner.
Yeah, I had another question, kind of dovetailing off what the chairman had pointed out earlier with regard to the passing reference by the judge below to having some prior knowledge of your client based on that earlier case between himself and this and the party Scrofano. I noted that, having read that, I didn't note that there was a footnote or even a passing reference to that in any of the pleadings. So I take it that you nor your client thought there were any inappropriate biases going on in her passing reference because you didn't raise it.
Your Honor, we do believe there's an inappropriate bias. We believe that the judge below is simply wrong on the law and would prefer to win that way. We don't like to argue about character if we can avoid it, or any issues as such. In that lower court ruling, what had happened is, I believe,
Did you represent the tenant before Ditch Pearson? At the time, you represented the tenant in this case before Judge Pearson, correct?
In this case, yes. Right. Not in the previous petition. I am very. I've looked through all the pleadings. What had occurred in that case was.
But you never filed on behalf of your client a recusal request.
No, I did not. In that previous case, my understanding is that it was between Mr. Harris, who is a lawyer, but he's a patent lawyer. He doesn't know anything about landlord-tenant law. He had a law student who was one of his tenants, and there was, I think, 7 motions filed on either side in that case. And it appeared that it rather annoyed the court, which never ruled on the motion, just ruled on the final hearing. And it did appear, especially given the judge's, immediate ruling of assessing attorney's fees against the tenant, which is very rare in the law, and it is only authorized in cases of frivolous arguments, when, once again, we believe these arguments are not frivolous, they're very sincere. We did believe that if evidenced bias, but it didn't appear at the time of appeal that there was an appealable issue on that, so we didn't notice it.
Would you, I'm going to ask one more. Your client is still a tenant, but he has subtenants, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. To the best of your knowledge, and it's a factual question, so excuse me for that, but is there still a landlord-tenant relationship between you and Mr. Zudu?
Yes, there is.
Has the rent at all been raised in the interim while this whole case has been in transit, shall we say?
It has not, because if it were, it would obviously expose them to a challenge to their fraudulent representation.
And that would again, this would be, essentially what you're saying to me is this is a remedy-less offense here, and it shouldn't be under the law. And if that is if the court if we have uphold the court below, because your client clearly believes that none of this would have occurred. That is, beginning with the agreement, had there been truthful representations by the other side as to, look, I'm not exempt, et cetera, the whole the process would have been radically different. So is it essentially, am I looking at a, or are we looking at a remedy-less issue here that you feel under the Act is there is reason to find remedy in this record, that we're not reaching out of the record to find remedies if we wanted to, if we deal with this as a remedial statute, you know, that looks out for tenants?
That's absolutely my argument, Your Honor.
Yeah, okay.
And just so we're clear, it's my argument. It is also our argument that res judicata doesn't apply.
Yeah,
so
gotcha.
There's no need to go outside.
Understood. Commissioner Spencer, Commissioner?
No, I'm exhausted.
Well, thank you so much, gentlemen. You both did a very good job in representing your clients, and we certainly are interested in this case, obviously, from our questions, and you did very well in upholding your position, so thank you. I would be careful on when you use a term of art. I'm just going to say this. Just be really careful if you're going to use small or say, you know, if you're going to use the same terms, just be careful that we're not confusing something that we know to be something that I knew what you were getting at, believe me, but the term voluntary agreement is a real loaded term up here, you know, when we have an action for that here, and so but I understood what you meant, small. I understood exactly what you meant. I just wanted to make sure you didn't tie yourself too closely to that concept under our law, because we wouldn't have been able to get very far with that. Okay.
Thank you, sir.
All righty. Gentlemen, thank you. It's now 3:12, and we're adjourned.